Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, the False Claims Act and FOIA Edition, Part 2. Thank you for tuning in. On May 16, 2011, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Schindler Elevator Corporation versus U.S. X-Rail Kirk. In general, the False Claims Act authorizes private individuals who discover fraud against the United States to sue on its behalf. If prosecution of the case is successful, the act allows the individual to recover a portion of the damages and penalties imposed on the defrauder. There is, however, a notable exception to the general rule. The act does not permit a private individual to sue based on information that was previously disclosed in a government report or investigation unless the individual was the original source of that information. The question in this case is whether alleged fraud disclosed in a federal agency's response to a Freedom of Information Act request falls within the government report or investigation bar to suit. In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court held by a vote of 5-3 that a federal agency's written response to a request for records under the Freedom of Information Act constitutes a report within the meaning of the public disclosure bar. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Alito joined the opinion of Justice Thomas. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion, which Justices Breyer and Sotomayor joined. Justice Kagan took no part in the consideration or decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Elizabeth P. Papez, who is a partner at Winston & Strawn, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Papez.
This is Elizabeth Papez at Winston & Strawn to talk about the Supreme Court's May 16 opinion in this term's False Claims Act case, number 10-188, Schindler Elevator versus Kirk. The headline, for those who haven't already heard it, is a 5-3 decision, Justice Kagan was recused, reversing the Second Circuit and holding that written Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, responses and their attachments are, quote, government reports that trigger the so-called public disclosure bar that protects businesses from key TAM suits under the Federal False Claims Act, or FCA. Justice Thomas authored the opinion for the court with Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor in dissent. Before I go any further, I should disclose I'm a former law clerk of Justice Thomas's, although I did not know that when I undertook the task of podcasting on this decision, which I did after the oral argument as well. So with that disclosure, which I don't think impacts the analysis, the decision is obviously an important one for the business community and the federal government because it clarifies the scope of a significant limit on an area of multi-billion dollar litigation that relates directly to recent government efforts to pursue individual corporate executives for program debarment and criminal sanctions. The opinion is also notable because it previews some legal questions that are likely to impact this area of the law in the next few years. Just some quick background before we get into the opinion itself. The case arose when Daniel Kirk, a former employee of Schindler Elevator, filed a QI-TAM, or private attorney general, suit in federal court alleging that Schindler violated the False Claims Act by accepting payments on federal contracts without satisfying the contract's requirement that the company file certain statistical reports with the Department of Labor. The allegations were significant because the claim exposed Schindler to damages of more than $100 million, of which Schindler, as the government's representative or relator, stood to gain up to 30%. Kirk's allegation that Schindler did not file the federally required reports relied heavily on Department of Labor responses to FOIA requests that Kirk's wife submitted before Kirk filed his lawsuit. Schindler seized on this fact to argue that because FOIA responses are public information, the case should be dismissed under the FCA's so-called public disclosure bar, which prohibits private individuals like Kirk from pursuing cases based on public information, including, quote, government reports, unless the individual is the original source of the information. The federal district court agreed with Schindler and dismissed the suit on the grounds that FOIA responses are government reports covered by the disclosure bar, which was designed to prevent private parties from reaping financial benefits from suing for alleged fraud that the government already has a basis for investigating. On appeal, though, the Second Circuit reversed and split with several other circuits in holding that Kirk's reliance on the FOIA disclosures did not trigger the bar. As noted, the Supreme Court has now reversed the Second Circuit and held that written FOIA responses and their attachments are indeed government reports for purposes of the FCA's public disclosure bar, although the court left for remand the question whether Kirk's suit is, quote, based on the FOIA disclosures and thus cannot proceed. The opinion begins with a footnote I think is important because the footnote acknowledges that the Health Reform Bill, or PACA, amended the FCA's public disclosure bar, but did so after Kirk filed suit. So the court's opinion addresses the pre-health reform version of the statute. This disclaimer, I think, is unremarkable on its face, but touches on an issue with some significant backstory. As I mentioned in the post-argument podcast, the FCA's QI-TAM provisions are a bit of an odd fit in our constitutional system because they allow private parties the government does not directly control to reap significant financial bounties for litigating in the name of the United States. Because such parties may have incentives to invoke the government's enforcement authority in situations that normal government employees might not, the proper scope of the FCA provisions allowing QI-TAM suits is an issue that has bounced back and forth between the courts and the political branches for decades. In the latest round of this debate, the Supreme Court construed the QI-TAM provisions in ways that limited these lawsuits, and Congress responded by using the health reform, Dodd-Frank, and another statute to amend the False Claims Act in ways that basically overruled several of the Supreme Court's recent decisions. Whether the current Schindler opinion will prompt a similar legislative response is unclear. But I think it's at least possible, given that the dissenting opinion expressly calls on Congress to target the majority's decision. In what I think is an unusually direct call on the legislature, the dissent says that the way that the court has construed the disclosure bar's coverage of FOIA responses severely limits whistleblowers' ability to substantiate their allegations in their lawsuits, and thus that the majority's construction of the bar is a, quote, question worthy of Congress's attention. I think this language in the dissent is notable not just because it evidences the contentious nature of the debate within the court and the federal government over QI-TAM suits generally, but also because it suggests that the dissent believes the court's decision will have or could have a significant impact on QI-TAM litigation, notwithstanding the majority opinion's opening footnote and focus on the health reform, on the pre-health reform version of the statute. I actually think the dissent might be right about that. The court's opinion begins with a textual analysis of the relevant statutory language, namely the public disclosure bar's reference to, quote, government reports, and concludes that the ordinary or dictionary definition of the word report is broad enough to encompass FOIA responses. The opinion then considers the operative provision in context and concludes that the Second Circuit's error, which the court said carried over to the SG's brief in the case, was in not taking this contextual step far enough. Specifically, the court faults the Second Circuit for looking, quote, only to the immediately surrounding words in construing the term report, which the court highlights as the same interpretive error it corrected in its 2010 public disclosure bar opinion in a case called Graham County Soil. I think the court's emphasis on Graham County is notable because Congress expressly took aim at that opinion and effectively overruled it in the health reform bill amendments to the public disclosure bar. Nonetheless, and perhaps to reaffirm both the controlling nature of its underlying analysis and the court's authority to say what the law is, the Schindler majority holds that applying the interpretive approach set forth in Graham compels reversal. The reason it explains is that when report is read in light of all the sources of public disclosure the statute references, including the very broad reference to news media, it is clear that the public disclosure bar encompasses written FOIA responses. Because the court relies on the foregoing analysis to find the statutory language unambiguous, it emphasizes at page 9 of the opinion that it need not go on to consider the FCA's legislative history or various policy arguments for and against the Second Circuit's ruling. Having said that, though, the court's opinion does explain why it finds both the Act's drafting history and policy objectives consistent with its ruling. Notably, the court emphasizes what Justice Stevens' opinion and Graham identified as the FCA's goal of striking a, quote, balance between encouraging private persons to root out fraud and stifling parasitic lawsuits that would enable key TAM relators to recover large bounties for pursuing fraud or potential evidence of fraud that is already known to the government, and thus would not serve the goal of assisting the government in rooting out fraud that would otherwise go undetected. The court goes on to explain that construing the public disclosure bar to cover written FOIA responses clearly furthers this balancing goal and emphasizes, though again it leaves the final determination for remand, that Kirk's suit seems, quote, a classic example of the opportunistic litigation that the public disclosure bar is designed to discourage. That's the opinion of page 10. The reason, it explains, is that if the QI-TAM suits could proceed based on FOIA responses, literally anyone interested in rolling the dice on a bounty award could identify a few regulatory filings and certification requirements, submit FOIA requests until they discover a federal contractor out of compliance, and then potentially reap a windfall in a QI-TAM action. The opinion concludes thus that both the textual and extratextual evidence in the case compels reversal of the Second Circuit. As most of you already know, and as I mentioned, the decision has generally been hailed as a victory for business. I think it is, because the upshot is that it places an important check on private parties' ability to use FOIA responses as the basis for bringing QI-TAM suits. And as noted, that is a matter of real consequence for two reasons. First, these suits have multi-billion-dollar consequences for both the government and any company that does business with the government, whether as a federal contractor or through participation in federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Second, FCA judgments have been the basis for the government's recent efforts, particularly in the healthcare area, to pursue debarment and criminal sanctions against individual corporate executives like the CEO of Forest Labs. So those are the big headlines on the business front for the opinion. I think they're accurate, but I also think it's important to get beyond the headlines in analyzing the court's opinion. And on that score, I just want to say a couple of final things. I want to start off by noting that the court's method of interpreting the statutory text is not itself remarkable because justices across the court have, particularly in Chevron cases, long employed the same methodology, namely consideration of an operative term's ordinary meaning followed by its construction and context to construe statutory provisions. What I think is significant as a forward-looking matter is that the court found the operative language unambiguous, and that it did so by looking at contextual terms that the health reform bill did not eliminate. This analysis, I think, has two important consequences. First, the conclusion that the statute is unambiguous eliminated what many of the court's precedents identify as the need to consider legislative history and other evidence of congressional intent in construing statutory provisions. Eliminating that need is notable here because some members of Congress have gone on record in recent years to say that the Health Reform Bill amendments simply, quote, clarified what the 1986 version of the FCA, which was the version at issue in Schindler, already provided. The court's conclusion that the statute is unambiguous, however, renders consideration of such statements largely irrelevant, and lower courts applying the language should probably take note of that. The second significant aspect, I think, of the court's statutory analysis is that it relies on statutory terms, notably report, all sources of public disclosure, and news media, that the health reform bill did not eliminate, and thus the analysis may well carry over into litigation under the FCA as amended by PACA. As noted, this may explain the dissent's express call for congressional action, which call would otherwise seem to me at least anomalous, if not unnecessary, given that the court's opinion leaves at least two doors open for saving Kirk's lawsuit, notwithstanding its reliance on the FOIA responses. First, the court expressly leaves for remand the question whether Kirk's suit is, quote, based on the FOIA response for purposes of the bar. This is significant because a conclusion that a suit is not, quote, based on the FOIA response would not trigger the disclosure bar, and thus would seem to allow a relator to do exactly what the dissent urges, namely proceed with an FCA case that is based on independent knowledge but uses FOIA responses to, quote, substantiate its allegations. Second, the court's opinion expressly declines to decide the scope or application of the original source exception to the public disclosure bar, which again could provide a relator like Kirk an additional safety valve to proceed with a case that relies in part on FOIA responses. I say could because the proper scope and application of the original source exception is an issue that has divided the circuits and could ultimately be resolved in a way that would not apply to relators like Kirk. The same is true of the proper scope and meaning of the disclosure bar's reference to government investigations, whose interpretation the court's opinion also expressly leaves for another day. Accordingly, I think the bottom line on the opinion is this. The ultimate result in the case is fairly characterized as a victory for business, but the court's statutory analysis is not, in my view, fairly characterized as result-oriented. I think it employs a settled interpretive methodology that justices across the court have used in a wide variety of cases to find statutory language unambiguous, and its conclusion that the provision in issue unambiguously includes FOIA responses is consistent with that analysis and also with the FCA's history and purpose. I do think, however, that the dissent's disagreement with the court's conclusion, and particularly the dissent's explicit call to Congress, is evidence that this case is indeed the latest chapter in the separation of powers battle that the court and the political branches have waged in the FCA context for decades. And I further think the opinion's express identification of, but refusal to decide, several important FCA questions is a preview of what the next few chapters in that debate might look like. How the court would decide those questions is anybody's guess. I will note, however, that in this case, the oral argument, which does not always provide a good sense of the court's direction, proved predictive. In the podcast that followed the March argument, my first guess, based on the justices' questioning, was a 5-3 reversal, and that's exactly where the court ended up. So I think it'll be interesting to see how lower courts apply the analysis in this decision in addressing the rising number of FCA suits on their dockets. And it'll be interesting to watch which aspect or aspects of the FCA litigation the Supreme Court as well as Congress will take up next.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.